The weather is rather cool this morning, and I'm dressed in all black again, which happens to go well with these black birds that I'm feeding, which are called American coots. While they may resemble ducks, they're not actually a duck species, but rather have chicken-like beaks, legs, and feet. While some may symbolically associate them with death because of their color, in most cultures, the black raven was, and still is, considered as the bird of death. Some people also believe that when a wicked person died, he became a raven. But the raven is also a sign of transformation, and hence associated with magicians and sorcerers. In Norse, Celtic, and Druid mythology, the raven is considered an animal of great wisdom and intelligence. Besides death, their dark feathers often also represent rebirth or resurrection, like the phoenix, while their intelligence is symbolic for deeper esoteric knowledge. I'm reminded of a line from The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe, quote, "Deep into that darkness, peering, long I stood there, wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before." Near-death experiences are triggered during life-threatening episodes when the body is injured, usually by a blunt trauma, heart attack, or some sort of sudden shock. About 1 in 10 patients with cardiac arrest in a hospital setting undergoes such an episode. Thousands of survivors of these harrowing touch-and-go situations tell of leaving their clinically deceased bodies behind and encountering a realm beyond everyday existence, unconstrained by the usual boundaries of space and time. These powerful, mystical experiences can lead to permanent transformation of their lives. Near-death experiences are not fancy flights of the imagination. They share broad commonalities, becoming pain-free, seeing a bright light at the end of a tunnel, and other visual phenomena, detaching from one's own body and floating above it, or even flying off into space, in what some also refer to as out-of-body experiences. The experience might include meeting loved ones, living or dead, or spiritual beings such as angels, accompanied by recollection or even review of lifetime memories, both good and bad, or a distorted sense of time and space. There are some underlying physiological phenomena associated with these perceptions, such as progressively narrowing tunnel vision, and the experience itself can be interpreted as either positive or negative. For most, these events fade in intensity with time, but in many cases, they are recalled with unusual intensity and lucidity over many decades. In 1791, for instance, British Admiral Sir Francis Beaufort almost drowned, an event he recalled in this fashion, quote, "A calm feeling of the most perfect tranquility succeeded the most tumultuous sensation, nor was I in any bodily pain. On the contrary, my sensations were now of rather a pleasurable cast, though the senses were thus deadened. Not so the mind. Its activity seemed to be invigorated in a ratio which defies all description, for thought rose after thought with a rapidity of succession that is not only indescribable, but probably inconceivable by anyone who has not himself been in a similar situation. The course of these thoughts I can even now in a great measure retrace. The event that had just taken place. Thus, traveling backwards, every incident of my past life seemed to me to glance across my recollection in retrograde procession. The whole period of my existence seemed to be placed before me in a kind of panoramic view. Another instance was recorded in 1900, when Scottish surgeon Sir Alexander Oxton succumbed to a bout of typhoid fever. He described what happened this way, quote, "I lay, as it seemed, in a constant stupor which excluded the existence of any hopes or fears. Mind and body seemed to be the dual, and to some extent separate. I was conscious of the body as an inert, tumbled mass near a door. It belonged to me, but it was not I. I was conscious that my mental self used regularly to leave the body. I was then drawn rapidly back to it, joined it with disgust, and it became I, and was fed, spoken to, and cared for. And though I knew that death was hovering about, having no thought of religion nor dread of the end, and roamed on beneath the murky skies, apathetic and contented, until something again disturbed the body where it lay, when I was drawn back to it afresh." More recently, British writer Susan Blackmore received a report from a woman from Cyprus who had an emergency gastrectomy in 1991. Quote, "On the fourth day following that operation, I went into shock and became unconscious for several hours. Although thought to me unconscious, I remembered for years afterwards the entire detailed conversation that passed between the surgeon and anesthetist present. I was lying above my own body, totally free of pain, and looking down at my own self with compassion for the agony I could see on the face. I was floating peacefully. Then I was going elsewhere, floating towards a dark but not frightening curtain-like area. Then I felt total peace. Suddenly, it all changed. I was slammed back into my body again, very much aware of the agony again." In trying to understand the near-death experience, and in particular, how there can be consciousness without brain activity, I'd like to turn to a brief excerpt from a presentation made before the United Nations in 2008 by Dr. Bruce Grayson from the panel discussion Beyond the Brain, the Experiential Implications of Neurotheology, speaking about how the brain does not equal the mind and how near-death experiences can contribute to knowledge about the mind-body connection.
Sometimes when you talk to many near-death experiencers who assume that they left their bodies and therefore their brains behind, you start wondering, where did we ever get this crazy idea that brains are involved in thinking? You know, where did it come from? Obviously, it comes from our everyday lives. In our everyday lives, it seems as if the mind and the brain are the same thing. When you get knocked on the head, you don't think very clearly. When you get drunk, you don't think very clearly. It seems very obvious that the state of our brains affects the state of our thinking, our emotions, our thoughts, our feelings, our desires. And that seems to hold true for much of our daily lives. It doesn't seem to hold true in the extremes. Let me give you an analogy. Henry Stapp this morning talked about Newtonian mechanics, which was accepted for 300 years, 400 years as a description of this wonderful clockwork world we live in, which was perfectly acceptable. And Newtonian mechanics, treating the world as if it's billiard balls, works very well for most of our daily lives. When you throw something up, it falls down all the time. The harder you throw it, the faster it goes. Newtonian mechanics works fine for everyday life. It's only when you get to the extremes of measuring extremely small particles or extremely fast speeds that the Newtonian model breaks down. It's not that Newton was wrong. It's just that the formulas he was using are a limited case. And when you get to the extreme examples, his formulas no longer work, and you need relativity to make the corrections. In normal everyday life, the corrections that relativity adds don't make much of a difference. And Newtonian's formulas are a good approximation. I think the same thing is going on with the brain and the mind. In our everyday life, assuming that the brain and the mind are the same thing works perfectly fine. It's only when you get to the extreme cases, such as when the brain stops functioning, that you see the analogy breaking down. And brain and mind do not seem to be the same thing. The most common example that's talked about now is the near-death experience, where you have people, many people who seem to be clinically dead, a few people who've actually had flat brain waves documented, who come back saying, not only was I thinking, but I was thinking more clearly than I ever had before. But we also have other examples of cases in which, when the brain is compromised, people think more clearly. There are exceptional cases of people who have irreversible dementia or severe mental illness, who in their dying moments before they die become perfectly lucid. They start recognizing family members, they start talking coherently, they lose their delusions, and then they die. What is that all about? We don't have a materialistic explanation for this. If you assume that mind and brain can separate when the brain starts to deteriorate, then you have an explanation. You can't do a lot of research on that type of experience. Those are just isolated anecdotes, and believe me, they are unusual. Most people who die with dementia die with dementia. They don't come out of it. But we have these isolated cases that tell us something else is going on. But within your death experience, we have a potentially researchable lab to look at what's happening when the brain goes down. Now, we have ways of extending the life of the brain, for example, by hypothermia, by giving it different drugs to reduce its need for oxygen so it can keep going for longer. And you can argue about how dead is dead. But as Sam Pointy mentioned this morning, if you get down to the point where you have an isolated neuron, an isolated nerve cell still functioning, does it make sense to say that neuron is hungry or is angry or has consciousness? We don't think so. How about if you have two cells connected together? Can they be hungry? Most neuroscientists think you need an entire intact neural network to have anything like consciousness. And clearly that is not going on when you have perhaps some rudimentary brain activity in the deep brainstem. Whatever you have, if you have any brain activity, it's not what we usually think is required for consciousness. So we have brains that are not functioning well enough to produce consciousness, and yet we have people saying, I was conscious throughout the whole procedure. In fact, I was more clear then than when I'm stuck back here in the brain with all the limitations of the brain on me. Is there anything that's verifiable in all this? We have people saying to us, yes, I was thinking clearer than ever before. That was more real than this. How do we know that there's anything to any of this? Well, occasionally people bring back from a near-death experience some verifiable information. And this is the same thing that Sam is trying to do with this AWARE study, trying to put targets that are unexpected in places where people can see when they leave their bodies. And we have lots of anecdotes of people who have done this, who have said, yes, I left my body, and I saw Dr. So-and-so kick over the stand, or I saw this or that, and they're accurate. And sometimes they are very surprising things that they report to us, things they couldn't possibly have guessed. We also have people bringing back from a near-death experience information they couldn't have gotten about other things as well. Sometimes they have met and communicated with deceased loved ones who have told them information that they couldn't have gotten in another way. There are cases of people who have met these deceased loved ones that no one knew had died. And we have many cases documented this, where people who talked about seeing deceased relatives included Uncle Joe, who everyone thought was still alive. And you didn't find out until days later that Uncle Joe had died a few minutes before this person has a near-death experience. How do we explain these things in terms of neurological function? So these are ways in which, from a near-death experience, you can get some verifiable information, which can bear on the question of, are these things, quote, real? Obviously, they're real for the experiencer and for people who interact with the experiencer. I have the luxury of working with physicians. And you heard Jeffrey Schwartz this morning tell about the animosity that you sometimes face from scientists when you talk about, when you challenge their materialistic beliefs. I've seen that happen among a lot of basic scientists. I haven't seen it so much among clinicians, among practicing physicians. And here I really resonate with Esther Sternberg's hopefulness about where the future of medicine is going. Because doctors are much more like engineers than they are like scientists. They care about what works. You know, the scientist wants to know What's the theory behind this? If it doesn't have, if you don't have a theory for it, I'm not going to pay any attention to it. Where's your theory to combat materialism? You don't have one? Forget it. Doctors won't do that. Doctors will say, if it helps the patient, I'll use it, whether I understand it or not. So we have something that is very real for the patients and very real for the physicians who take care of them. And with the objective measures we're getting now from studies like the one Sam is doing, we can have some more objective, verifiable information, which hopefully will convince the others in the scientific world that this is something that needs to be explained. We have lots of data that materialistic science can't explain. I have here a book called Irreducible Mind, which my colleagues published last year. 800 very densely packed pages of scientific data from the world of medicine that do not fit into the materialistic model. Things from psychosomatic medicine, from faith healing, from placebos, from hypnotic effects, to near-death experiences. Things that cannot be explained by materialistic worldview. What is the materialistic scientist's answer to this? These are anecdotes. They're isolated facts. And that's all we have until we have a comprehensive theory to explain it. And I think that is partly why you see the animosity that Jeff was talking about this morning. We don't have a good competing theory. Now, Sam talked this morning about dualism, which is an alternative to monistic materialism, but there are lots of problems with that. When you get right down to it, dualism has just as many problems as materialism does. We simply don't have the explanation. I would argue, though, that we have enough data now that we need to start looking for the explanation. Did I answer all your questions?
Yeah, it's amazing. Okay.
Dr. Bruce Grayson argues that the general features of the near-death experience include impressions of being outside of one's physical body, visions of deceased relatives and religious figures, and transcendence of the egotic and spatio-temporal boundaries. Many common elements have been reported, although the person's interpretation of these events often correspond with the cultural, philosophical, or religious beliefs of the person experiencing it. For example, in the U.S., where 46% of the population believes in guardian angels, they will often be identified as angels or deceased loved ones, while Hindus will often identify them as messengers of the gods of death. While there's still a considerable amount of debate as to the actual role of the brain in regards to its relationship to what we call the mind, especially in light of near-death or out-of-body experiences, there seems to be more consensus as to the effects these experiences have on the person having them. Changes in personality and a new outlook of life are a common after effect. And among these changes, we often find a greater appreciation for life, higher self-esteem, greater compassion of others, less concern for acquiring material wealth, a heightened sense of purpose and self-understanding, a desire to learn, elevated spirituality, greater ecological sensitivity and a planetary concern, and a feeling of being more intuitive. Of course, not all after effects are positive, and Dr. Grayson describes circumstances where changes in attitude and behavior can also lead to psychological distress and other unwanted phenomena.
And this brings me back to my very first question concerning the function, the general function of the brain, according to you. I mean, yeah. Doesn't the experience, the kind of research you are familiar with concerning near-death experience forces us to reconsider the very basic assumptions concerning the general function of the brain, even concerning ordinary cases. And my suggestion would be actually something that William James, people like William James and Henry Bergson, at the beginning of the 20th century, formulated in a very nice way. They just suggested that maybe we were going the wrong way. Maybe the brain is not so much that which creates consciousness or brings about all these phenomena. Not so much that kind of creative, active engine as a something like a reducing valve or something like a transmitter, much more like a TV receiver that kind of translates electromagnetic waves into images and sound. I guess this is where your research points to, but I'm not right. sure you would embrace this view.
Yeah. Well, I think. I'm not going to embrace any of those views because I think they're all models. You know, William James, who was living in the steam era, used the reducing valve, a model from the steam engine. And people since then have used the television analogy that the brain is like a receiver for the television signals. We keep changing our models. Now with the mind is software and the brain is hardware. But the point is that the brain is not producing thought. It's receiving thought or limiting thought in some way. And in that model, the brain is the way that the mind has of functioning in the normal world. I'm not going to embrace any of these things because I think they're all so locked into our very limited models. Let me come back to something that was mentioned this morning, and that's the role of language in all this. If you ask a near-death experiencer to describe what happened, they will usually start off by saying, "I can't. It was ineffable. There are no words to describe what I went through." And then we say, "Great, tell me about it." And we force them to use words. And then we write down what they've said as if that's the truth. But the fact that we made them use words doesn't mean the words were an accurate representation. And in fact, if you look at cross-cultural comparisons, there's a core near-death experience which is the same all over the world. But you don't have the same vocabulary described all over the world. Here people talk about it, tunnels. People in third world countries don't talk about tunnels. They may talk about a cave or a well, or one person told me about going into the stem of a flower. I had one truck driver told me about going into a tailpipe. So your cultural background determines what words you use. People who come from a culture where you have a belief in a god will talk about seeing God. People from cultures where there isn't a god, but the Buddhist cultures, don't talk about seeing God in their near-death experiences. They may talk about seeing deceased relatives. They may talk about just about a warm, loving sense of whatever it is. When the Star Wars movies came out, a lot of near-death experiencers say, "Yes, the Force, that's it, it's the Force." I think it goes deeper than just our language. There's a problem in how the culture makes us think that distorts how we describe things. As Sam mentioned this morning, so much of the way we think about things came from the ancient Greeks. And in fact, our system of logic, of how we deal with ideas, is determined by Aristotle's, it's called a twofold system of logic, where things are either true or false. He postulated the law of the excluded middle. Things can't be both true and false. They have to be true or false. And that type of logic leads us to have what we've called mysteries, things we can't explain. So we can choose between trying to reduce them to things we can't explain or saying, it's a mystery, we can't solve it. That's because we're locked into this yes or no law of the excluded middle. Other cultures don't have this. There is a Hindu system of logic that was developed by Nagarjuna, in which there are four different types of logical statements. Things can be true, or they can be false, or they can be true and false, or they can be neither true nor false. And all those are logical statements in their system. And when you think about what physics is doing these days, remember what Henry was talking about this morning. We have things that don't fit into our logic. So philosophers can say, well, quantum physics is illogical. Maybe it is by Aristotelian logic, but not necessarily by another type of logic. Is a photon a wave or a particle? According to Aristotle, it has to be one or the other. It can't be both. But in other forms of logic, it can be both or it can be neither. So maybe what science has to do, what scientists have to do, is get beyond our own prejudices and start using not only other languages, but other ways of evaluating the language, other ways of thinking.
My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon, as well as through various other major book outlets. They make a great gift. If you'd like to support my work, you could do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those that are interested. I appreciate it. Thank you. Please hit the like button and subscribe for future updates. As always, I look forward to reading your comments. So please leave me your thoughts below. Please have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.